Chapter 2. The Fixer. Early in 2007, I received another call from Don Jr. asking for my assistance in a media relations matter that had come up. The younger Trump knew that I had a lot of connections in the press, from the New York Post to Politico, from my two runs for elected office, and they needed a resident in one of their projects to provide a testimonial for an article being written about a proposed project in Jersey City across the Hudson River from Manhattan that I was considering investing in. I was happy to help for no charge, as I now viewed the elder Trump as a pathway to the corridors of power in the city and beyond. I needed no instruction from the Trumps about what to say. This was the skill I would develop over the years as I became Trump's spokesman, thug, pit bull, and lawless lawyer. Trump viewed any representation of his name, brand, properties, or the products he endorsed to be a matter of the highest importance. He wanted all of his interactions with the press to be manipulated for maximum benefit, no matter the underlying truth. And in a postmodern society where the representation of the thing was more important than the thing itself, at least in Trump's intuitive way of seeing power and spin, that meant a relentless willingness to lie, exaggerate, mislead, and above all, brag and boast and boost. Trump properties are solid investments, I told the New York Post for an article about Trump titled Upping the Ante that appeared in February 2007. Michael Cohen has great insights in the real estate market, Trump said about me in the article. He has invested in my buildings because he likes to make money, and he does. Trump concluded, in short, he's a very smart person. This was the mutual admiration society we were forming, or perhaps we were just metaphorically jerking each other off, to be a little coarse. But Trump knew I'd love it when he'd sent me a signed copy of the article telling me what a great job I'd done. And so I did. Now impatient for more Trump action, it was only a matter of another few weeks before he called me again. Instead of the show-of-strength feats I had performed for him the first two times, now he wanted to draw on my legal expertise, I discovered. Trump's current lawyers had told him that the ongoing dispute with the board of directors of Trump International Resorts, what he referred to as the casino board, wasn't going well. The company was in Chapter 11 and faced liquidation and ruination. According to Trump's attorneys, he had no way to stop the board from continuing to limit and proscribe his ability to influence the company as liquidation closed in yet again. The agreements that Trump had entered into were too restrictive, they said, terms drafted by white shoe firms who had papered Trump's deal with the publicly traded company. In many ways, Trump Entertainment Resorts, or TER, was emblematic of Trump's career as a showman and entrepreneur. Trump styled himself as an iconoclastic businessman in Manhattan initially, but his time in Atlantic City was when he became a real fixture in the tabloids. The first crisis for the company came in the early 1990s with the collapse of the Trump Taj Mahal in Atlantic City, a potential catastrophe Trump had escaped in the short term by having his father Fred Trump buy millions of dollars worth of chips from the casino as a way to avoid reporting a loan to the casino regulatory board. Running to daddy and using his bank account for a bailout didn't square with Trump's image as a swashbuckling self-made billionaire, so this desperate move was little known and never discussed by Trump. Through Trump's years of repeated boom and bust, casinos had remained at the heart of his brand and business strategy, nearly always with the result that creditors lost money loaned to these concerns. Part of the reason virtually all of the banks in the United States refused to do business with him. In 2007, the board was now trying to negotiate a buyout with different suitors, hoping to attract private firms or publicly traded companies to acquire the failed enterprise. Michael, what do you know about bankruptcy and Chapter 11 procedures? Trump asked when I entered his office. Very little, I said, thankfully. The board is busting my balls, he said, ignoring what I'd said. My lawyers say that there is nothing I can do about it. I want you to read these documents and give me your opinion. I want you to find something I can use to bargain with. Trump handed me two giant documents, both more than 500 pages, each tome an ocean of legal technicality and detail. Whoa, I said. This is like War and Peace times two. Don't worry, he said. I want you to bill me for your time on this one. Just don't take advantage of your hours. I value your trust in me, I said. I would never take advantage of you. By the way, what is your hourly? The firm bills me out at $750 an hour. Shit, Trump said. You're expensive. But you gotta understand that I never pay lawyers their rack rate. I'm not worried. I know where you live and work. Trump ignored my attempted joke. I went home and started to review the documents. My education in bankruptcy law was a dim memory from my distant days in law school, and I was nobody's idea of a legal scholar. But I could read the documents and cross-reference the various provisions, and it was quickly evident that the odds were stacked against Trump. He'd self-evidently been negotiating from a position of weakness, which was typical for folks who are deep in debt and up against financial institutions used to getting their way. Trump was the chairman of the board, I saw, but it was really only as a figurehead. His rights as a member of the board were also basically non-existent in substance, and all of the real decision-making power was in the hands of others. The situation seemed dire, as might be expected for a company that had clearly been run into the ground by years of what seemed to be bad leadership and poor decision-making. It was clear that Trump wanted me to find some kind of loophole or legal technicality that he could leverage to his advantage. I was beginning to understand what Trump wanted from me. He didn't want me to be like his other lawyers, measuring the merits of a situation and providing advice based on sound legal reasoning. He had lawyers who could provide that kind of guidance. He didn't need me to be a lawyer when he was in the right. He needed a lawyer for when he was in the wrong, when he was trying to go around the law or offer a twisted or tortured interpretation to an agreement that could be used to screw the other side. Roy Cohn was Trump's platonic ideal as an advocate. In the 1970s, Cohn had represented Trump when he and his father Fred were investigated by the Department of Justice for discriminating against blacks in his rental properties in New York City. The truth was simple, as I would come to learn. The Trumps were actually racist, scheming to keep African Americans out of their rental properties. But that didn't matter to Trump. He wanted a lawyer who would fight when the cause was clearly racist and illegal. Roy Cohn had played the role of pit bull for Trump until the boss dropped him like a hot potato in his hour of greatest need when he was dying of AIDS. A fate I should have considered as I insinuated myself into Trump's world. That night, all I kept thinking was that I didn't want to disappoint Mr. Trump. That's how I put it in my mind. Like so many now, in Congress and in the press, I was willing to say and do anything to please Trump. I was exactly like Rudolph Giuliani would become. The crazed advocate mocking others and proving my unquestioning loyalty, even as it led to ruin. That night, I obsessed over the documents. I read and reread the pages looking for an angle, an argument, a way to give Trump an edge. Think, you dope, I said to myself. Think, you dope. I was pacing around the apartment, talking aloud to myself, getting mad at myself, finally outright yelling at myself like a demented football coach giving himself a furious halftime beatdown. God damn it, you can't fail, I hollered at myself. Find something, God damn it! Find something! Stop it, Michael, my wife Laura said to me as she watched me ranting and raving like a lunatic. If there is something in there, you'll find it. Calm down. This is his problem, not yours. Laura insisted we go to dinner with friends that evening, as we had planned, but I was hopelessly distracted at the restaurant. She took my hand and stroked me gently, reassuringly, and my worries faded away, at least for a while. But when we got home around midnight, I sat down with the documents and began to scour the terms again. "How long are you going to read tonight?" Laura asked. "I'll see you in the morning," I said. "Sleep tight." Laura rolled her eyes. "So stupid," she said, heading to bed. Deep in the night, sitting under my lone light in the living room overlooking Park Avenue, I stumbled upon the hook. I carefully reviewed the sections related to the Trump mark, as it was defined in the agreements, double and triple checking what looked like a potential hole in the brick wall the elite lawyers had constructed around Trump. My reading was perhaps unorthodox, and it certainly strained the underlying business intentions, in all likelihood, but it seemed like there was a defensible legal argument, or at least enough of a suggestion of one to raise an issue for Trump to bring before the board. The concept revolved around the licensing agreements that Trump had with the company as they related to the Trump mark and his ability to remove his name from a property if he was dissatisfied with how it was being managed. Trump could claim that TER was in default and that they had failed to cure the breach, I argued. Although there wasn't, in fact and in law, really a reason to claim a breach, times were very rough in Atlantic City yet again, and available funds were being spent on general maintenance and payroll, leaving certain elements of the Taj to fall into disrepair. Throughout all of his permutations since the early 90s, including bankruptcies and financial disaster, Trump had somehow managed to retain control of the food court and parking lot of the casino. If he alleged that both weren't properly maintained, that they were pigsties, Trump could use that as a basis to refuse the company access to those areas. A casino with no parking or food services would be in serious trouble, I knew, allowing Trump to have the upper hand as he demanded necessary repairs, which he would then slow walk or block from being done. The logic of the 2-page memorandum I wrote to Trump was immediately apparent to him. Trump effectively had no special rights as a board member or chairman, but this approach gave him a virtual veto over the company's activities. No food, and worse, no place to park the thousands of cars for staff and visitors, I said to Trump. Yes, said Trump. Nice. Trump held up the memorandum. How much time did you put into this? He asked. It took me around 100 hours, I said. The invoice is going to be around $100,000. Geez, said Trump. I thought we were friends. Trump eyed me, weighing what to say next. Look, you clearly love this shit, he said. It's exciting here, and you get to do great things. You must hate it over there at that sleepy old firm. It's not you. What are you saying, Mr. Trump? I asked. Would you be interested in working for me directly, answering only to me? I didn't know what to say, because I was dumbfounded. Can I have a day or two to think this over? I asked. No, Trump said. I'll send my guys over to pack up your office and bring your stuff here in the Trump Tower to my floor. I'll set you up in Ivanka's old office. Trump offered a lowball salary. I countered, and we met in the middle. Less money than I was making at my firm, but I was already wealthy with my taxi medallions and real estate holdings worth millions, so it wasn't the pay that most interested me. The attraction was the action, the game, the deals, the thrill of the chase. Don't tell anyone how much I'm paying you, Trump said. I don't pay anyone that much. Okay, I said, but what about my invoice? Invoice, he said. You want to get fired on your first day? I didn't think about the fact that I had been recording my hours at my law firm and that Trump owed the firm the fees, not me personally, another indication of how untethered from a normal way of behaving I was beginning to act. My little brother still worked at the firm, and he was soon getting harassed by the billing department for the Trump payables. The first step in our falling out of touch as I entered the hall of mirrors of Trump's world. Sitting in my new office on the 26th floor a few days later, my new desk neatly tricked up with two phones and two staplers and two legal pads at the ready, I read about an ongoing dispute in the Trump Park Avenue development, the building where I lived. During the renovations, from its former glory as the glamorous Delmonico Hotel, the place where the Beatles met Bob Dylan, to give just one example of its storied history, the construction crew hadn't removed a ledge-like feature from one of the higher floors on the back of the building. The ledge looked like a balcony, but it didn't have railings, and thus constituted a significant danger to residents, making it impossible for Trump to obtain the necessary certificate of occupancy without its removal. For months, Trump executive Matthew Calamari had tried to resolve the issue with the owner of the unit with the ledge to provide access for a crew to remove the hazard, but the man had refused to cooperate. He was unwilling to put up with the dust and noise and adopted a belligerent stance. I noted the man's name, recognizing him as a fellow resident I saw in the lobby from time to time. I was filing the matter away, hoping a solution would bubble to the surface, when I went to dinner that evening with some friends who also lived in TPA. Over veal parmigiana at an uptown eatery called Elio's, I heard a scandalous story from our friends. The couple had been in their bedroom the night before, making love, when they were startled by the sight of a drunken teenage boy leering at them from the ledge of the apartment next door. My friends were furious, saying that the kid was about to go to college and they weren't sure what to say or do about the peeping Tom intrusion. This was incredible good fortune, I knew instantly. The name of the kid involved was the same as the man who had been giving the Trump organization a hard time. The tables were about to be reversed, with prejudice, I realized, with scarcely concealed delight. The next morning, I called the man, introducing myself with my new title of Executive Vice President and Special Counsel to Donald Trump, and laid out the case for allowing access to remove the ledge as a safety hazard and a courtesy. I was patient and lawyerly. "I'm not doing shit," the man replied. "Is that right?" I replied. "That's correct." "Well, you might want to think about that," I said, my temper rising, "because I know for a fact that your son was on that ledge a few nights ago and he did a freaking peeping Tom act on your neighbors. The kid was drunk with a bunch of buddies having a party at your place, so they were screwing around and intruding on the privacy of your neighbors in a way that just might be a criminal offense under New York law." "I don't know what you're talking about," he said, now sounding uncertain and scared. "You know that college your son has applied to," I said? "The one you've been working so hard to get him into? Well, how are they going to like it when I tell them that your son is a drunken pervert spying on your neighbors? How about the police? What are they going to think? Your wife? Because that's what's going to happen." "You can't, I just did," I said, cutting him off and now talking with menace in my voice. "This is as serious as a heart attack. What you're going to do is execute the document I'm going to email you in the next 20 minutes, or I'm going to bring hell down on your shoulders. Your choice." 20 minutes later, I was in Trump's office brandishing the executed permission to enter the apartment and make the necessary renovations. The issue had eaten at Trump for months, the kind of infuriating dispute that got under his skin and drove him crazy. He wanted his way at all times, and he wanted it immediately. "No shit, Michael. How did you get this?" "I can't tell you," I said. "Come on. Why not?" "Plausible deniability," I said. "Boss, there are some things you don't want to know about, and this is one of those." "Wow," Trump said, contemplating the release with wonder and delight. "This is a real Roy Cohn move." I knew there was no higher praise from the man I was starting to call boss. On the last day of my first week, I was summoned by a call from Trump's assistant, Rona Graff. she told me that Trump wanted to see me. "You called me, boss?" I said, standing at the threshold to Trump's office. "Yeah," Trump said. "Grab your jacket. We're going to the GM building for a meeting of the Trump Casino Board. We're leaving in 5 minutes. It's only a couple of blocks, so we'll walk over." "Yes, sir. I'll bring my file." This was the moment Trump was going to deploy my legal strategy on the board of TER. I was dutifully waiting at the elevator when Trump arrived in his customary oversized jacket and extra-long red tie. Descending to the ground floor and the pink marble atrium, Trump walked into the crowd of people shopping in the lobby, mostly tourists come to gape at the American excess the building personified. Stepping out of the elevator, an electric current traveled through the atrium as people turned in disbelief and caught sight of Trump's distinctive orange comb-over and hulking presence. The Apprentice was the most popular reality show on television at the time, making Trump a genuine celebrity. But this was more than the adulation given to an actor or a rock star, it seemed to me. Trump embodied an entire portfolio of ambitions and desires and resentments for countless people, including me. To an outsider, my attraction to Trump, or as I described it, my obsession, seemed to have its roots in money and power and my lust to possess these attributes, if even only by proxy. What other explanation was there for my starstruck, moth-to-the-flame compulsion to insinuate myself with a man so transparently problematic in myriad ways? But I knew the real answer for me and others in Trump's world, and eventually for a significant percentage of the citizens of the United States. The answer I was coming to see included something deeper than the obvious lures of money and power, though those were crucial factors. It was physical, emotional, not quite spiritual, but a deep longing and need that Trump filled for me. Around Trump, I felt excited, alive, like he possessed the urgent and only truth, the chance for my salvation and success in life. It was only the beginning of my tenure with Trump, but this day was etched on my soul, even as I gave that soul over to the man I worshipped, a word that wasn't too extreme to describe the devotion I was starting to feel. Trump could have quietly exited the building through a rear entrance or in a car from the parking lot below, but he thrived on the attention the tourists and passers-by heaped on him. What was a cheap jolt of adrenaline for Trump and a way of showing off his new acolyte attorney, for me, represented something mystical. "That's Donald Trump," the rumblings began amongst the midday crowd in the atrium. Growing more loud, like a wave rippling over the large space and turning to an excited din, the exclamations turned to, "That's Donald Trump!" and catcalls saying, "Tell my son he's fired!" Trump stopped for selfies and signed whatever was put in front of him, from clothing to baseballs to bare skin. The voyage from the elevator to the revolving door onto Fifth Avenue was perhaps 100 feet, but Trump and I had barely moved a few feet when the crowd started closing in. I remember this like it happened yesterday. Trump glanced in my direction, gave me his devilish grin, and winked at me. He motioned for me to come closer as the masses started to jostle and push to get closer. When I was right next to him, he whispered, "This is what Trump is all about." The energy, the action, the chaos. It was intoxicating, and I never wanted it to stop. I was a junkie in need of a fix. Even though the attention wasn't for me, I didn't care. I was in the very important persons section of this small, exclusive club, and I loved being there. Finally arriving at the GM building, catty-corner from Central Park South, Trump again did selfies with the security guards, and then we went up to the meeting of Trump Entertainment Resorts. In the boardroom, I outlined Trump's position on the buyout proposals under consideration and how he controlled the parking lot and food court, and both were in a state of disrepair, putting TER in default. as Trump's designated hard ass, I described the consequences for the board if they failed to heed Trump's directions on the matter. Insolvency, chaos, disgrace. I laid it on thick and heavy. As I spoke, Trump suddenly interrupted. I surmised that he felt that his attorney had brought the issues to a head, and now it was time for the billionaire to bring down the hammer. I watched in silent admiration as Trump laid down the law to the board in a dramatic and overbearing fashion. The board likewise stunned into silence. The food court and parking lot were shitholes, he said, and the disgraceful disrepair entitled him to demand the breaches of contract be remedied. In the meantime, that gave him veto power over the company, and that meant that the board had to do what he wanted, whatever that happened to be. Then Trump suddenly stopped talking. The meeting was far from over. It was really only just beginning, with many difficult, unresolved issues to be addressed. But Trump didn't care. He sensed he had an advantage, however transitory or weak in substance, and so this was the moment he ended the meeting, as if he were yelling cut on the set of his own personal reality television show. Michael, we're done. Let's go, Trump said. This meeting is over. My head was spinning. Still high from the adoration in the atrium at Trump Tower, now I was storming out of a high-powered board meeting with hundreds of millions of dollars on the line, and Trump had suddenly, unilaterally, melodramatically called an end to the proceedings, apparently for no other reason than that he could. Trump's supposed victory was pyrrhic and short-lived. As events emerged in the coming months and years, Trump Entertainment Resorts would fail to find a buyer. Despite Trump's histrionics, it ended up in bankruptcy again in 2009, owing in excess of $1 billion. In 2014, the company would file for bankruptcy yet again, turning union members into another class of stiffed debtors. Its assets dwindled to the pathetic specter of a hulk of an abandoned wreck, once known as the Trump Plaza in Atlantic City, waiting for its demolition. With blown-out windows, gilded ceilings collapsed, and giant holes in shoddy floors, the eyesore and fire trap illustrated the delusional and failed business endeavors of Trump. A blight on the boardwalk, once the epitome of Trump's wildly ambitious approach to business outlined in The Art of the Deal in the 1980s, the bluster and bullying that Trump displayed at the board meeting might have given me pause. But it didn't. To the contrary, I was even more ardently astounded by Trump's performance. Walking through the lobby at the GM building the day of the Trump Entertainment Resorts board meeting was like the experience at Trump Tower, only even more intense, with as many as 1,000 people jostling for a peek, a photo, an autograph, some connection to a man so many held in awe. I felt like I belonged to something, someone, special and important. It didn't occur to me that the entire spectacle had been staged for my benefit. Not because I would actually benefit in any way, of course, but that it was part of a performance meant to draw me into Trump's centrifugal force, precisely in the way a con man draws a mark into his world. Like a confidence artist, Trump was showing me that he inhabited a different type of reality, one that he would share with me alone, a world that was filled with wonder and excitement and power and intrigue and adulation. All I had to do was do what I was told, without question or a second thought. I didn't just accept this invitation, I leapt at it. I wasn't Trump's mark as much as I was his acolyte, a willing participant in a fantasy that heightened my senses and my sense of self. "Stay close, my man," Trump whispered to me in the lobby. "These are Trump people." Isn't this something?